Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hit it. Hit it, Charlton.
There we go.
It worked.
There we go.
Yeah, it worked.
You just say it and it just happens.
I Life have the moment. Power.
There we go. Hey, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. Me and Molly talking about tech, the economy, culture. Our weekly deep dive episode is today, Tuesday, the big show. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to dig in on the show today to that phrase that's been around for a bit now, and it's getting some traction, defund the police. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what it means and where it might get us, actually, which is kind of the promising part, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And it is as simple as that, right? Like, this phrase has been going around. It seems to mean a lot of things to a lot of people. The kind of basic idea is that budgets, city budgets, are a moral document in some way. Where does the money go? And could it instead be used to fund other things, social services and other initiatives, so that in a way police aren't responsible for so many issues, let alone protected in incidents of brutality and so on and so forth. And basically, we just wanted to be like, what is the deal? What does this mean?
Yeah.
And what would it mean if we did it?
Yeah.
You really do have construction.
Yeah, I do. And I'm really sorry. I don't know what to do about it because they're building a house next door. So hopefully folks can hear through this. Anyway, so we are going to talk to Tahir Duckett today. He's a civil rights attorney in Washington, D.C., also a founding executive committee member of Law for Black Lives, D.C. Tahir, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So look, can we start with the semantics of this thing first and what defund the police means to you and how we might help explain that, first of all?
Yeah, certainly. And I'm, you know, fully recognizing that a lot of people are, you know, new to this concept. And it's a concept that Black organizers and activists and community members have been pushing for quite some time. And I think that, you know, what's happening right now is as people get a closer look at what our police forces are actually doing nationwide, that folks are starting to question whether or not what they're providing us is worth the incredible fiscal cost as well as the extraordinary social and community-based costs. So what activists are calling for is for us to stop relying on police to keep each other safe and start building infrastructure that is going to keep us safe outside of relying on police and incarceration in prisons.
And so I feel like this is sort of the part that we want to dig into, because in some ways is it also a conversation about refunding so many sort of elements of society that we stopped funding? Like, you know, part of this conversation is about how police are asked to provide mental health care, intervene in schools, deal with domestic violence, take care of homelessness, like so many programs that we haven't funded, but that we have shunted to police, right?
Certainly, or that we never seriously funded in the first place. What we're looking at when we look at policing is, you know, nationally, municipalities spending close to $115 billion every year on police. And that's just municipalities. So put aside the federal government and the transfers of equipment from the military to municipalities. That's just that's just dollars coming out of local funds. And when you put that number next to the numbers that you see that are spent on our departments of health or on homeless services or on housing preservation and development, youth and community development, violence prevention, you're talking about just a staggering disparity. NYPD's police department's budget is $6 billion, and that's more than all of those services that I just mentioned combined. So, you know, when people are talking about defunding the police, they're not saying defund the police and that's the end of the story. They're saying defund and reinvest those funds into other ways of keeping us safe and healthy in our neighborhoods.
Reforms have been tried and almost entirely failed in policing in this country. Why? First of all, why do you think they failed, and why is the defund movement a better option?
Well, yeah, certainly. And I mean, I think, first of all, the reason why the defund movement is a better option is because these other reforms have failed. It's not as though we haven't tried other things first, right? We, you know, 5 years ago, we had a series of uprisings across the country. And, you know, everybody said, okay, Black Lives Matter, you know, let's do better. You know, we're going to invest in implicit bias training, and we're going to invest in body cameras. And, you know, 5 years later, what's changed? Not very much, right? We have still the same number of people being killed by the police every single year. If the implicit bias training has taken hold, it's hard to see evidence of it out in the streets these past couple of weeks. And so, you know, what I'm seeing from organizers and activists is they're saying, we have tried reforms. We have talked about reforms since Rodney King. And, you know, this is an institution that is notoriously and persistently resistant to reforms. And I think that you can see that in the words of police unions who, despite all the evidence of what we're seeing, seem to think that there's nothing wrong with policing. I think it's, you know, when you see the video of the 75-year-old man in Buffalo who's pushed down, and then the police officers, you know, finally, just a little bit of accountability, and then the entire police department shows up and applauds these folks. You know, I think that that is telling that there's something going on in the culture of policing that is so far divorced from what a lot of us wanted to believe was true about policing. I think we've wanted to believe that, you know, these are heroes and that they're taking care of us and that they are, you know, friendly neighborhood cops. And I think that what's been put on display these last couple of weeks is, you know, that most of America is starting to see the police for what most Black neighborhoods have experienced as policing for decades.
What are the relationships between, and apologies if this is not your area, but the relationships between municipalities and police departments? Like in Minneapolis, you know, it sounds like the city council has promised to defund the police force and dismantle it completely. But my understanding is that the way the city relationship with police is set up, in Oakland, for example, I don't think the mayor is in charge of the police. Like how, just as a practical matter, how hard is this to pull off?
Well, you know, it's certainly difficult to pull off because, you know, again, organizers and activists have been building to this moment for, you know, for years. And mm-hmm. So while for a lot of people, this feels like something that is overnight, I know here in Washington, D.C., for instance, we have had this battle with Mayor Bowser year after year after year, asking for, you know, greater accountability, asking for smaller police departments, fighting the knee-jerk reaction to just hire more cops at every turn. And every municipality's relationship with police is a little bit different. And these are battles that are going to have to be fought city by city by city, by county, by state, across the country. But across the board, you know, these departments are funded by municipalities. right? So whether or not the mayor themselves is in charge of the police department, those budgets are, you know, generally passed by city councils and signed by mayors. And they can make different budgetary decisions. And I think that activists are asking them to do so.
As this becomes more of a political issue, which it certainly will as the presidential campaign heats up, I think it's worth emphasizing that point. You are looking to city hall and state level governments. You're not necessarily looking to Washington for relief on this, or are you?
I mean, I think that's exactly right. The central front here is in our cities. And so let me be clear, there are things that Washington can do to help. You know, Washington can get rid of qualified immunity, which has given police officers immunity for, I used to say, all but the most absurd violations of our rights. But, you know, just this past year, the Supreme Court declined to take up two cases, one in which police officers stole $225,000 during a search warrant. And the Court of Appeals said, yeah, you're immune from that suit. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, okay, no problems there. And another case where a police officer body slammed a woman, broke her collarbone, knocked her unconscious, all because she walked away from him when he told her not to. And again, the Court of Appeals said that you're immune from suit. And the Supreme Court apparently had no problem with that either. And so, you know, that's a fix that can happen in Washington and would be a valuable fix. It certainly would help to stop directing so much of our used military equipment into our communities, tanks, grenade launchers, you know, these just ostentatious displays of force that make Black communities feel more like occupied neighborhoods than like real safe communities. Those are things that Washington can help with as well. But, you know, you'll notice that most of these folks, you know, they're going and they're marching on their city halls. They want to know what their mayors and their city councils are going to do to really keep them safe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like you said, a lot of America is new to this phrase, this concept, this idea of defund the police, and a fair bit of America is having a pretty visceral reaction to it, you know, and saying, who am I going to call?
Yeah.
Like, how, apart from conversations like this one, right? How do we make this idea? How does the idea become politically feasible on a broad scale to people who hear it and go, what? I need them, you know?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. And I think people need to understand a little bit more about their communities and about, you know, how dangerous their communities actually are. Look, the reality is that, you know, not only is crime in general at some of its lowest rates since most of us have been alive, but the reality is that crime is actually relatively rare, right? So in D.C. in 2019, we had 1,600 violent crimes. We have 4,200 police officers in the District of Columbia, right? And so this idea that police officers are spending all their time tracking down and responding to violent crimes, that the majority of police officers are, what they're doing is they're there for you when you call them because your house is being robbed or something like that. It's just not the reality of what police are doing every day from day to day. You know, we don't need a standing army of 4,200 cops in D.C. to respond to 1,600 violent crimes over the course of the year. I'll tell you what, that is, for each police officer, you know, a violent crime that they're dealing with every couple of years or so. If my job had me, if the justification for my job was that I need to be there to do something once every couple of years, then I'm not going to be employed very long, you know? So I think that folks have to recognize that first and foremost and realize that instead what we're doing is we're putting extraordinary amounts of basic social services into the hands of the police. So let me give you another example. I was walking down the street a few years ago in Washington, D.C. late at night, and I came across a woman, you know, who was walking down the sidewalk. She was bleeding like from her arm pretty vigorously. She was completely confused. She didn't know where she was. She didn't know where she was going. She couldn't really tell me much about what her problem was. And, you know, I wanted to have somebody to call there who would be able to help. And, you know, my only option in DC is to call the police in that situation. The last thing I wanted to do was to call the police to show up with guns to respond to a woman who is confused and didn't know where she was. I wanted to be able to call, you know, a mental health therapist. I wanted to be able to call a social worker. I wanted to be able to call somebody who was well versed in all of the services that the city can provide in a situation like that. But I didn't have that number to call. So I had to call the police. And, you know, fortunately, you know, me and a few other people who stopped to join in kind of protected this woman because, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen when those armed officers showed up. I think that the very first thing that people who are trying to defund the police are asking for, that the lowest hanging fruit, the thing that I think that we should all be able to agree upon is, you know, cops shouldn't be responding to calls like that. I don't need a cop to be called to deal with, you know, a homeless person who's, you know, sleeping on my front doorstep. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need a cop to show up and help resolve, you know, a conflict between two neighbors. Those are things that we can invest in our communities in different ways and ways that are less dangerous for Black people in particular and also safer for the health of our communities long term.
So do you think, as you step back and look at where we are, that this time is different?
I think it feels really different. And I think that there's a few reasons why this feels different. First and foremost, while people have been making these calls for a long time, I think that what's happening in Minneapolis is really encouraging. Cities have disbanded their police departments before. Camden, New Jersey did it a few years ago. Essentially, they busted the union. They fired all the cops. And then they rehired some cops back who they thought that they could reform. And then they brought in a reformist police chief. And, you know, I think a lot of people, once Minneapolis said, hey, we're going to get rid of our police department and we're going to try to envision a new way of keeping ourselves safe, I think a lot of people said, oh, okay, well, maybe they're just going to do what Camden, New Jersey did. But it sounds like they are really open to engaging with the community members who, you know, live in the neighborhoods most affected by policing, who are policed in the ways that a lot of people say, oh, I don't know if, you know, who's going to keep me safe. They're the folks who live in the neighborhoods that are actually being most affected by crime and who are asking for this, right? And who are saying, look, let's do something different. We believe that there are new ways of keeping ourselves safe. And I think that what we're going to see is, as folks start to reallocate funding from, you know, this enormous level of bloat that, again, I think that, you know, we all should be able to agree upon, that if that money truly is reinvested into the community, I think that we're going to see crime rates fall. I think that we're going to see the communities themselves become safer and healthier and more economically vibrant communities. And that is going to give us the opportunity to continue making the argument that we can find ways to keep each other safe that don't rely on these frankly antiquated police departments.
Tahir Duckett is a civil rights attorney focusing on racial justice and a founding executive committee member of Law for Black Lives DC. Tahir, thank you so much for joining Make Me Smart. You made us smart. That was fantastic.
Thank you. I appreciate it. These are important conversations, and I think it's important for all of us to keep working on getting smart when it comes to this stuff.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Take good care. We appreciate it.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I feel like anytime you come away and you're like, I learned something from the show and you're hosting it, that seems like a positive. That seems like a positive. Yeah, that's a win.
For sure.
We are headed for a break. We want to know what you think about this idea of defunding police departments and kind of like what you think, if you are new to this phrase, what did you think when you heard it? And what do you think now after that conversation? I think that's what we'd like to know. And of course, anything else. And don't forget that questions are coming up tomorrow. So record yourself in a voice memo if you want to tell us your thoughts directly. Send it to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Email us your questions, your comments, your thoughts. We'll be right back.
Okay, we'll be right back.
Okay, we'll be right back.
There we go.
Okay. Here we are. It worked. It's because I said
all right, we're back.
That's what makes it work.
We are back. That's right. Well, you know.
Apparently, I'm in charge.
From Mollywood's lips to Charlton Thorpe's ears. That's the way this goes. I get it. All right, time for a little news. What do you like?
What you got?
Whoa, swinging my microphone. So, look, it's a piece from The Atlantic that I've got by Alexis Madrigal and somebody else. I apologize for not having the whole byline right in front
Robinson
of me.
Robinson Meyer.
But.
I clicked it.
Thank you very much. But I think it's incredibly important and it's so totally lost in the shuffle. We have given up on this pandemic. We have decided it's all right. We're done. And there's a lot of things going on now. I get it. People want to reopen and there have been the uprisings and the protests and it's tough to keep in mind that you have to wear a mask and stay apart. But it's clear that collective action is done on this. And that's just scary because the virus doesn't care.
Right.
The virus doesn't care.
It's scary because the virus is already spiking. And I think like it is really, really important to note here that there has been a huge spike in the number of reported cases. And I really want to make it clear that they all reflect infections that almost certainly began, that did mathematically begin before the protests. I imagine that we're going to get into this weird backlash cycle where we are also going to blame protests for the spike in increases. And the fact is, it was reopening. Like, arguably, I saw this article too, and I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure we gave up on this months ago. I mean, there was literally an article that quoted an unnamed White House official saying, oh, the president has been over coronavirus for weeks now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's, yeah.
Yep.
So I don't know. There was also a piece recently about in 1968-ish, in the 60s, yeah, there was a flu pandemic.
Yeah.
Have you heard about this? So I'm literally like looking it up at the same time because it was basically, they said, if you want to know what it could potentially look like to just let this thing run, you actually only have to look as far as 1968 when there was a huge flu pandemic. It was far less severe than the 1918 flu pandemic that killed between 25 and 50 million people. The influenza pandemic of 1968 resulted in an estimated 1 million to 4 million deaths, which is right on track with what the College of London predicted if we were to essentially like not intervene in the United States. I don't know if that's global though, or if it's just the US, because like I said, I looked it up real quick on the Encyclopedia Britannica, but very similar in some ways, really similar situation where it was like we were embroiled in the Vietnam War. There were protests over that. And there was like, of course, all the political upheaval and assassinations of 1968. Yeah. And so they were basically like, we don't have time to, you know, lock down the economy.
Right. And we have now collectively decided that we are not going to intervene. I mean, are individuals doing things? Yes. Are some companies doing things? Yes. Are some states and counties doing things? Yes. But writ large, we're like, yeah, okay, it's here. Next. Which I just think is bananas.
Do you think we are? I mean, yes. As a matter of federal policy, certainly, yes. Yeah. Over.
Yeah.
One day it'll just disappear. It'll be like a miracle. I'm sorry. That was unnecessarily snarky, or was it unnecessary?
I think it was a quote, actually, is what it was.
It was a quote. My news item is actually interestingly on the topic of policing in a way. There's been this big conversation about tech companies and the reactions that they're all having. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're all saying like Black Lives Matter and this is really important to us. And we really support our 8 Black employees. And, you know, people are sort of rightly pushing back and saying like hiring diversity in the tech industry is abysmal, even by the metric of hiring in corporate, you know, America overall. And on top of that, a lot of tech companies sell tools for surveillance. In some cases, like on a super secretive, in a super secretive way, see Amazon and its recognition with a K, facial recognition product.
Right.
And so I thought it was very notable that IBM wrote to Congress yesterday, Monday, and said, we are exiting the general purpose facial recognition business, and specifically said that it opposes the use of this technology for mass surveillance and racial profiling.
Yeah, that's something,
which
right?
Which is a pretty
and
big deal.
Props to them. Because, yeah, it's a big deal on a really controversial topic, which has been misused by authorities here and around the world. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I think it is. Because I think it's also a pretty big potential business, which is why so many of them are in it. But, yeah, anytime you see a company say, this is why we're going to do it. And, look, maybe it's a business decision. It could certainly be, like, cover for the fact that the business wasn't doing very well. But this technology has well-documented, deep, deep, deep flaws when it comes to recognizing black and brown faces, not to mention the surveillance concerns, which, you know, the ACLU is just basically, I think, probably has an entire department devoted to facial recognition.
For sure.
Yeah. So that was a big deal.
Yep.
All right.
Moving on.
Shall we dig into the mailbag?
We shall.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
I will never not love that sting. That's all I'm saying. okay. So last week, I asked all y'all whether you think this is a hinge point. One of those moments where you look back and you say, that's where change happened. A couple of you responded. Here's one from Marvin Ramirez. He says, yes, this is definitely a time for change. The definition of a successful economy must be more than an increasing stock market value. I'm all for competition and maximizing profits, but profit maximization must not be achieved on the backs of the masses at the bottom. Every one of us is, first and foremost, a human being. Yes, there will always be a hierarchical class structure, but to have a successful economy, every one of us has to have our human needs satisfied. Each and every one of us needs to feel secure. We need clean water, clean air, safe and nutritious food, shelter, education, and meaningful occupation with paid time off, and a sustainable infrastructure capable of providing these basic human needs. Most of everything else that our current economy provides are wants. The wants should be the carrot to incentivize people to work harder, achieve more, and raise their standard of living. About which I agree completely, Marvin. But the question was, do you think it's going to be a hinge point? Not why should it be? Because it should be, and you've said all the reasons. But I think, you know, I mean, look, Tahir said yes, he believes this time is different. I've had other people say yes, they believe this time is different. Lord, I hope so. But, that's all I'm saying.
I know. There's still the problem of Facebook. and yet I want to believe.
Evergreen snark right there.
Did you see the Financial Times piece that defined, which was actually absolutely perfect and true? It started with the definition of an oligarch, which is essentially like, you know, someone who gets and maintains power by staying close to those who are in power, power and money.
Yep.
And they were like, by any definition, that is Mark Zuckerberg.
Mm-hmm. Look, he controls the biggest empire this world's ever known.
He controls the biggest empire this world has ever known. Yep, that is absolutely true. And the way that he will maintain that control is to continue some version of the status quo, at least politically, in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I am like, the filter is off. I am tired, friends. Look out. We have to Kai's point about that Atlantic piece. We obviously have been talking a lot on the show about reopening the economy, when and how that should happen. The fact that it apparently just is. We have all been thrown to the wolves now. One listener, Peter Diebel, was brave enough to go to a Universal Orlando water park last week. Okay. And he reported back on that experience. And here's what he said. I am actually very, he says, torn on this subject. My father and mother are in compromised health. I'm militant, he says, about wearing masks. On the other hand, I live in a town that's dependent on tourism dollars, and we know that it will be a couple of years before our economy really rebounds. And he says, I think we have to open up in some way so that these companies can have some revenue and continue to employ their workers. So then let's fast forward, he says, to the experience. When we got to the water park, cars were parked every other spot. There were team members with handheld thermometers to take our temperature from maybe 6 inches from our heads. given the okay, we went through security and then boarded our bus. There's a bus. Okay. There was a, he says this was a full-size transit-style bus with 14 passengers on board, everyone masked. Masks were required in restaurants and stores, recommended when walking between rides, and optional on the rides. We followed their rules and initially wore our masks when walking to the rides, but not on the rides. For the Universal team members, all workers had masks. When entering some of the rides, they would offer hand sanitizer. Restaurants are no longer self-service. So he said you wait in a socially distanced line. They have a team member who gives you a paper menu and then sends you to another space where you meet up with a runner, takes you to a seating area and assigns you to a table. Wow. Basically, he said, you know, look, a lot of our neighbors in Orlando will have to make the best choice they can from several crappy options, which will be to go to work and hope for the best. But what I really want to know is, how did you feel? Did you feel like it was all okay?
Yeah. Was it fun? That does not sound like fun. I mean, I'll tell you. So my wife and my younger kids went to a local protest that we had here a couple of days this past weekend. And my wife said after about 20 minutes, she got like freaked out by all the people being around, you know?
Yeah. I drove up to Sonoma County on Saturday with my germ pod, my ex-husband and my son and his stepmom. Yeah. We're a modern family, friends. Because they have this great, because Sonoma County reopened and they have this beer garden. It's an outdoor beer garden. I was like, oh my God, all I want to do is like order a beer from a human and sit outside and drink a beer. Like, that sounds amazing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we drove up, we had like a little picnic in a regional park, and then we got to the beer garden, walked around the little town a little bit, and the beer garden was just like packed with people. And although the tables were, you know, 4 to 5 to 6 feet apart, like people weren't wearing masks because they were drinking beer. And literally we were all just like, no, no, thank you.
Yeah.
No, no, no. Yeah. And we left. And that, I mean, that can't be discounted as a reaction that a lot of people are going to have, I think.
For sure.
When they go to a place and they're like, no one's wearing a mask and whatever. But yeah, like.
For sure.
I'm not. And then Sunday was like the emotional blowback from that because I was like, I'm not ready for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's scary.
We should say here, Sam puts in the Slack that that our Orlando guy did feel safe. So there you go.
Well, all right.
Okay, on the way out, the Make Me Smart question, as always, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? This week, Chrissy Clark, she's the host of our documentary podcast that we do on Marketplace, The Uncertain Hour, deep investigative reporting, a new pop-up season now. They had a whole different thing planned, and when all of what we're all now living through, the pandemic actually, not the rebellions and the uprisings and the protests, but when the pandemic started, they pivoted to do something called A History of Now, which is cool. The histories and policies that are making sense of where we are. Here she is, Chrissy Clark from The Uncertain Hour.
So I never met my grandma, but she was alive during the huge earthquake and fire that devastated San Francisco in 1906. And growing up, my dad would tell me these stories that she'd told him about the aftermath. And the thing that he used to always talk about was the sense she gave him that a disaster had been this great equalizer. There were details in the stories she would give about the rich and the poor of the city living together in the same makeshift tent cities. And growing up, this idea was comforting to me. I didn't realize at the time that it was a common trope, that it was almost a cliche. But I've been thinking a lot about those stories recently as my colleagues and I have been reporting on the coronavirus pandemic. We've been hearing from Black and Latino workers at chicken plants who have had to risk their lives working in crowded conditions that expose them to the coronavirus, while many of us, including me, can work safely from home. Hearing from workers in restaurants and service industries who also happen to be disproportionately Black and Latino, who've been much more likely to lose their jobs because of the pandemic's economic fallout, and on and on. And I don't mean to sound like a bummer, because I think that what I've come to realize is that it's just that there's nothing inevitable about a disaster becoming an equalizer. What a disaster is more of a revealer. And if we like the idea that disasters can be these great equalizers, then the question is what policies are in place that get in the way of that, and what would it look like to change them?
Yep.
Well, and look, that's what we were talking about at the beginning with Tahir, right? What would it look like to change him? Because that's the deeper meaning of defund the police, right? And the problem, of course, is that it's being taken at face value by people who are new to the phrase, instead of at the policy level by people who've been living this for generations. You know, that's the deal.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm having one of those moments where I am grateful for our show. Like, mm-hmm. I personally am grateful that we are in a position where we can be like, we would really like to call somebody up and understand this better. And it helps. It helps. That's it for our show today. Don't forget to sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter, marketplace.org/newsletters. And we will be back tomorrow with What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? And I'm guessing it's a lot.
Yeah. Good point.
Kind of glad I don't have to go through those.
That's right. Make Me Smart, produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to Ben Hethcote. He does video for us. Our video intern is Ethan Parrots. Erica Phillips is the writer and producer of our smart speaker skills and our newsletters and all kinds of good stuff.
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. And so even though I joked that I was in charge, I clearly was not, because that man is on it. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday. Daniel Ramirez, the executive director of On Demand, is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager, Deborah Clark.
All right, let's get the show on the road. GoPro's going to run out of batteries here before we're finished. So, Ben, apologies in advance, pal.
My brain is going to run out of batteries before we're finished.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.